WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andreas, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Conflict is our topic for this portion of today's morning show. And conflict is something that most of us prefer to avoid, although certainly it seems like sometimes there are people who sort of thrive on conflict, seek it out, manage to generate a fair amount of it. But I think it's fair to say that just about all of us, whether we run from conflict or seem to seek it out, do not handle conflict as wisely as we might. One powerful means to perhaps confront conflict in better ways, in more productive ways, is a really marvelous new book called Changing the Conversation, The 17 Principles of Conflict Resolution. This is a book by Dana Casperson, who has made conflict something of a specialty in her life. That is not creating conflict, but trying to help others deal with conflict in their lives. And she's done it in some intriguing ways, including as a choreographer and dancer and performing artist. And so she has done this in the world of dance and in doing a great deal of work as a conflict mediator, offering workshops and so on. And this brand new book furthers her work. And I'm very, very excited to have this opportunity to speak with Dana Casperson about her book, which is published by Penguin, again called Changing the Conversation, 17 Principles of Conflict Resolution. Dana Casperson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm glad to be talking with you. Let's find out, first of all, at what point conflict became a topic of such great interest to you. I mean, ahead of you, for instance, exploring worlds of dance and choreography and so on, at the back of your mind, was conflict already sort of a pressing issue?
I would say about 10 years ago, it started to rise up in me as a desire to learn more about what might be possible in conflict, to understand how I could act more effectively in the world and create situations of transformation rather than experiencing conflict situations that shut things down or drained energy.
Were you encountering it maybe more and more? Or, I mean, was this something that was sort of pressing in on your own life personally? That is, conflicts in which you were involved or that you observed in others?
I experienced, I think like most people, conflict in my personal life, sometimes in my work life. I saw people around me experiencing conflict in all different areas. And I saw how much, essentially, suffering there often is in relationship to conflict and how unnecessary it is on some level, the level of suffering. And I began to ask myself, is there not some other way to deal with this? And so I started to do research, and I started to work toward trying to find a way, not only for myself, but ways to offer ideas about conflict that would be helpful for people in any situation.
Was this ahead of then your pursuit of a master's degree in conflict studies and mediation?
Yes, and that's where that led me eventually to get a master's degree in conflict studies and mediation. And I first got a master's in dance, which is coming out of, I've been a performer, a dancer and actress for 35 years professionally. And I'm still in the company right now. So now the last 10 years, I've been slowly building a practice that brings these two fields together.
Very intriguing. I wonder if you could say a word about the field, the academic discipline of conflict studies and mediation. I mean, over the course of, for instance, your pursuit of this master's degree from the Woodbury Institute at Champlain College in Vermont, what kinds of things did you ultimately study and explore?
So this degree is oriented to a large degree toward mediation. So and the style of mediation that I practice is one where the mediator never tells people what to do. So it's very much oriented, my practice in general, toward empowering self-determination in people in difficult situations. So in the degree program, we studied mediation, a very practical hands-on way of learning how to be a person who can sit with others in difficult situations and help keep unfolding the conversations that are happening so that people can find new pathways. We studied negotiation and all kinds of different arenas, ethics, lots of different things over the 2 years. And then we had field studies where we would go out and work in different arenas, because conflict, of course, is everywhere. And it's also a very important part of our life. It is the basis of creativity on some level, as I see it. And so a mediator can work in so many areas. So part of what this degree was oriented toward was to see, okay, let's look at the world. Let's see where conflict is happening. Let's figure out how it can be transformed in those places where it's destructive. And let's figure out how people themselves can be empowered to create constructive conflict out of destructive conflict.
One important question that is on my mind as I think both about the academic discipline of conflict studies and mediation, which I know next to nothing about, so you're helping me understand this, and about the focus of your book, is when we are talking about it in these terms, are we mostly focused on conflict between two individual people, or does the academic discipline and, for instance, efforts like your book also involve conflicts that are on a much wider sort of canvas? I mean, conflicts that involve, for instance, whole groups of people, whole races of people, or even country versus country. Or is that sort of a different matter that needs to be, I mean, obviously related, but that needs to be thought about and approached in different ways?
So these principles in this book are very basic actions that are scalable from conflicts that happen internally in a single person to two people, to groups, to communities, to nations. And there's also the question of systems, because systems themselves can become violent, meaning that they cause harm that's avoidable, that's not avoided. And so the practice of conflict workers is very broad, and some people specialize in political arenas. But at a very basic level, the skills are the same. And the principles in this book speak to those skills.
One other question before we focus more specifically on your book, which again is called Changing the Conversation. Mm-hmm. I noticed from visiting your website that one of the ways in which you have folded this interest and concern into your life, into your professional life in particular, and I think you've already made brief mention of it, is the fact that you oversee certain events which employ certain elements of dance and choreography, particularly in events which evidently are called choreographic public dialogues. Could you just say a quick word about what those are and what happens at them?
Yes, I've been developing a series of these choreographic public dialogues whose goal is to use motion as a way to enable communication between people. And this is choreographic thinking, but it's not dancing. So there's no dancing in the events. We're using simple physical action as a way to make it easier for large groups of people to communicate about things that they care about and about issues that are at stake. For example, in Germany, I've been doing a series of these on the topic of immigration, which obviously at the moment is very much in the news, and it's a topic that's very very important in Europe and in America for different reasons. And I recently have also been working on a project on violence. So what happens here is I use people's placements in the room, simple gestures, walking, and other simple physical ways of describing ideas to help people. And at first I thought it would make it harder for people to communicate. I didn't believe people would feel comfortable, but people feel very comfortable if the motion is not embarrassing, which is the most important thing. And so I've become more and more brave in terms of using these choreographic ideas, because people actually kind of relax, and it's more fun than a typical public dialogue where either one person's talking, everyone listens, or people are sitting together with over long periods and just talking. So the motion brings a liveliness, and it brings a basic sense of human connection, because there's a kind of interpenetration that happens when people move together in groups, regrouping and regrouping around ideas.
Hmm. I know that you do some of your work and live some of the time in Germany.
Yes.
I wonder if you see much in the way of dramatic difference between how some of these intriguing methods are received in Germany, for instance, versus in a place like Vermont. I mean, do you primarily do some of this groundbreaking work in Germany or here in the United States as well? Do you find receptiveness?
I actually did a project here in Vermont last year where I worked with groups of young people to develop a new model, a physical model, that we then used to create a public dialogue process on violence. And the reactions are actually very similar. People are relieved when they find a way to offer up their ideas that's not overwhelming for them, that's not too exposing, and yet brings them into a community of dialogue. And my next goal is to take the project that I did here in the States and develop it into an international series of choreographic public dialogues on violence that I'm going to do in a number of different countries.
Exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I'm working on that project right now.
We're speaking with Dana Casperson, and now we want to focus our attention more specifically on this brand new book called Changing the Conversation, The 17 Principles of Conflict Resolution. First of all, and maybe this is kind of a strange place to start, but I want to start with the appearance of this book, the visual layout of this book, which is very, very intriguing. Mm. And I think it's going to really make a difference, given the fact that, you know, I think some people might really want to do better with conflict resolution, but might feel just kind of overwhelmed if they took in hand a book that was just sort of wall-to-wall text and just sort of seemed like a kind of insurmountable bar to leap.
Yes.
This book is just not like that at all. It is much more approachable, and the visual palette that is represented here makes it very inviting. Describe to our listeners what this book looks like and who is responsible for the look of the book.
So my partner on this project is the wonderful Joost Elfers, who's a book packager and producer, and he designed the book. So what he did was take it apart a bit. So the book in any case is in sections. So there's 17 principles, and I've divided them into anti-principles and principles, which makes the principle more evident. And then the book has very spread out text, and there's simple examples that are given that are set on the page in a graphic way that makes it really easy to see, for example, the ineffective way of maybe saying something in the more effective way. And he's also created a kind of a visual orientation, so you always know where you are in the book. If you're in the basic description of the principle, if you're in examples, if you're in the practice section. And it also creates, I find, a kind of openness which is what I hoped for with this book, is that it can be a kind of a workbook for people, and it can also be a place of reflection where you can also just open the book to any page and find an idea to work with. So as you say, it's not a giant overwhelming mass of information, but it's a very concentrated resource for people who are in a difficult situation.
Right. And I hesitate to even use this term because it's so overused that it scarcely has any meaning anymore, but this book is quite thought-provoking. It provokes thought. It really gets one thinking about how conflict sort of operates and the ways we tend to respond to conflict. So my hat goes off to you for achieving that in such an intriguing way.
Thank you. That's great to hear.
The 17 principles, and we'll talk about probably most of them, I'm just curious, how did that particular list get assembled? Did that list already exist someplace? Had you already sort of assembled those principles through the course of your studies? Or really for the purposes of this book, did you come up with them? And if so, how? What was that process like?
Well, my goal going into the book is to arrive exactly where you just described, at a book that wasn't just a big book of words. But I wanted to give people what they asked me for. People I've worked with said, you know, it would be great if I had just a book where I could look really simply at the basic ideas, I could remind myself, and I could practice. And so I attempted to take everything that I knew about conflict and that I'd learned and that people offered me, all the questions that I had, and condensed them into the smallest number of things that I could. And it turned out to be 17.
Was that a hard process? I mean, did you find yourself sort of struggling with what should be on that list, what should end up on the sort of editing room floor, or did you come to this pretty quickly and smoothly?
Well, it was actually it was a really interesting process, but it took me quite a while because my goal was, how do I find the most basic categories of action? Because this book is a book about action. And any idea that I had that I thought was important, I never threw an idea away, but I tried to figure out if there was a more basic categorical level to which it belonged, and I tried to get down to those most basic categories of action.
Hmm. That probably anticipates my next question a little bit, which is human beings are complicated, and
yes,
we come in all shapes and sizes and in bewildering variety, and so one of the questions that comes to mind then is, how possible is it to talk about something like conflict in a way that makes sense given the astounding variety of human beings that live on this planet? I mean, you have on this planet Kim Kardashian, and you have on this planet somebody like Mother Teresa and all kinds of other people. And in terms of the sort of the standard ways that people interact and so on, is it possible to find basic tenets of conflict and resolution of conflict that can make sense across that enormous swath of humanity?
Yeah. So this book is purposely oriented toward actions, as opposed to particular formulas or formulations of words, which doesn't work with a larger swath of people because everyone has their own way of expressing and themselves. And so these principles speak to the basic human needs, because all humans, from Kim Kardashian to everybody else, have the same basic needs, like belonging, the need to contribute, the need to have stimulation. All these basic needs are universal, essentially. And coming out of that are all our different interests, which vary. And basically, in a conflict, we tend to get stuck having discussions up on a level of strategy. So how am I going to get my basic needs met? All right, here's my strategy. I need a new car. I need to move, whatever it is that we decide needs to happen. But the important things are on a deeper level. And so these principles are simple actions that help us unpack the complexity of conflict. And each of these, I would say, I can't really think of a person who would not, who these wouldn't speak to, because they are such simple things. Like, the first principle is don't hear attack, which is not a simple thing to do, but it's something that happens to everybody, is that when we are attacked, we have a tendency to want to react to the attack. And when we do that, we get caught up in a secondary part of the conflict, and we miss the most important information underneath.
Right. What is behind the words themselves.
Right.
Which might spring out of hurt or fear or all kinds of other things.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, ahead of that, even before we get to the first conflict, the first principle, there's a very striking spread in which we see on the left hand of the page is just the big word conflict against a red background, and then to the right, you can't change how other people act in a conflict, and often you can't change your situation. But you can change what you do. And that points, of course, exactly to what you were saying, that whether you're in the inner city of Detroit or on a mountainside in Nepal or wherever you happen to be and with whomever you happen to be in a conflict with over whatever the matter is, that is a truth that you can take to the bank, that that you have control over what you do. And this book is all about trying to help you know what to do in these situations.
Yes, and what you can do, because for me the whole goal here is that people have the choice. They choose what they do, and becoming more conscious of what we habitually do allows us to be more free to choose what we actually would like to do, because oftentimes our reactions are more reactive in conflict, and they don't really represent how we would like to be in that conflict, and they don't help us get to what's important to us and where we'd like to go. And for me, that spread that you just pointed out is important to me, because this is about freedom. How do we remain free inside of very difficult situations? Free to choose what we want to do, free to let the other person be the other person without getting all tangled up in whatever is going on with them. And how do we then have the freedom to be able to see possibility where it at first seems very far away?
Another overarching matter, even ahead of the 17 principles that's pointed out in your book, is this. By choosing the approaches discussed here, you can change your conversations. By changing your conversations, you can resolve conflict in your life.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that people need to have their conversations changed? I mean, in what ways are conversations not what they need to be?
Well, for example, if we start a conversation out by saying something like, you know, you are just a complete control freak and it's impossible to collaborate with you, then we've set up a situation where the person has been labeled and placed as being a certain thing, and we're talking about them as a problem, as opposed to, say, in that same situation, if I said, I would like to have more autonomy in our collaboration. I'd like to talk about how that might be possible. So how do we change the conversation by taking the focus away from attack or evaluation, and taking it down to, first of all, what we care about? Okay, in that instance, say, I want more autonomy. Okay, so that makes it easier for the other person as well to get engaged, because if I say, I'm interested in how our collaboration is working, I would like some more autonomy, then that's a completely different conversation than you are a control freak and it's impossible to collaborate with you.
As tempted as we might be to say
those
words.
As tempted as we are to make those kind of evaluations, they tend to make the conversation worse and get us off track from what we really care about.
We're speaking with Dana Casperson. We're talking about her book, Changing the Conversation, The 17 Principles of Conflict Resolution. So the 17 principles are actually grouped in three sections. Mm-hmm. And again, as you already have stated, each principle is actually paired with an anti-principle, which would be sort of its antithesis, the thing we might be inclined to do, but the thing that we probably shouldn't do in favor of the principle that's the better thing to do. And the first portion, the first nine, are actually under the heading of facilitate listening and speaking. Mm-hmm. And of course, I suppose it almost goes without saying, and yet we need to say it, that this is the arena where so much conflict occurs, and it is important that we think about some important principles when it comes to the way we not only express ourselves, but the way that we listen to others as they express themselves. Mm-hmm. And we don't always think about those two things in tandem.
Yes, and you know, speaking of how my past as a dancer has affected my work, I think the way that I approach conflict is affected by the 40 years of work as a dancer, because the work of a dancer is a daily practice. So we come together in the morning and we have an hour and a half class where we practice basic actions. And we practice them over and over every day, and it's not with the assumption that we're going to get it done and it's going to be done, but that every day things fall apart a little bit and we need to reconnect with the idea behind them. So it's the same thing here, that because it is difficult to listen and to express ourselves clearly when we're frightened or angry or sad, these kind of principles are things that we can connect to, not in saying specifically what we should say, but in noticing, oh, okay, I see, right now I've gotten off track, I'm really attacking this person, and this is not helping. What else can I do? I can consciously shift my focus to a different action.
One of the most intriguing parts of this first list is principle one, don't hear attack, listen for what is behind the words. Mm. Listen for what is behind the words. How difficult does this become, in your mind, when we are talking about not our neighbor or not our coworker or not a fellow dancer, or but somebody who is more of a stranger, and maybe even somebody who really comes from a very different place, either literally, geographically, or figuratively? Mm-hmm. I mean, how difficult can this be to sense what is behind the surface words? Does that become much, much harder in those kind of situations when someone really is a complete stranger?
Well, I think that actually we can get into the same level of non-understanding with the people who are closest to us. So I don't think it has to do necessarily with those kind of differences, although cultural differences can be a big part of what creates conflict if we don't understand what's happening. At the same time, this basic principle, don't hear attack, is then you can get to that point by using the other principles. So it's partly about, again, changing what we're paying attention to. And this is a curious principle that people often at first say, you know, that doesn't make any sense. Not only is it a bad idea, because obviously I need to know if I'm being attacked, I need to defend myself, but what goes on later is that people start to realize that when we recognize I'm hearing attack right now, I'm totally caught up in the attack portion of what this person is saying, it makes it almost impossible for us to hear what they're actually trying to say, even if they're saying it, when they're saying it very badly.
So even when someone maybe is really intending to criticize us, mm-hmm. that still means that there is probably a meaning behind the words. I mean, sometimes people say things and they really don't mean it as an attack or a criticism at all. Mm-hmm. It's just it comes from a completely different place. And then sometimes that's exactly what somebody intends to do. But
yes,
you're saying, but there's even then there is another truth behind the words themselves.
Yes, and the goal of this principle is not that we should be martyrs or pretend nothing's happening, be idiotic in that way. It means let's change our mindset, because in conflict, every single person in a conflict is trying to express something that's important to them, and often they do end up doing it in hurtful, confusing ways, and then we can all really get off track. But if we can develop the practice, and it's really a practice that, as you say, it's not easy, but it becomes so much easier over time. And if all of these different principles can help us unpack the conflict, separate things out so that we can say, okay, first of all, I'm just going to take a step back and ask myself, if this were said without attack, what would it sound like? Getting used to asking ourselves that basic question is one of the most basic practices that I see as helpful in conflict.
Hmm. Related to that, it's actually principle 3. You suggest that in a moment of conflict, talk to the other person's best self.
Yes.
A really, really intriguing notion, I suppose not always easily done, but in a sense, a relatively simple thing for us to try to do. Not that it's easy.
Right. It's not always easy, but it's so effective in terms of shifting the tone of the conversation and the direction, because people tend to step up or step down to the level that we engage them on. So if I say to someone, for example, look, I'm not going to even talk to you about this because you're just going to overreact again, then I've cast them as someone who's not capable of being part of finding a solution. And then they'll typically react accordingly. If, on the other hand, I say, you know what, let's find a way to talk about this because it's really important to me, then I've placed it between the two of us as something that we can do together, that I see the possibility for us to do it. I've already opened up a space of possibility.
Hmm. One of my favorites in this first section of principles is principle 6. And this springs out of something that I remember hearing from some kind of child rearing expert or something. I think that's actually where I really did hear this idea that, you know, when you're a parent and a young child comes to you crying because Susie broke my crayons or whatever, rather than just trying to just shut them up immediately and discard what they're feeling, to just take a moment and acknowledge what they're feeling can make a huge difference. I mean, where that child just kind of blows out some of that anger and hurt, and the next thing you know, they're walking away sniffling and they're going to be fine. But of course, many parents don't react that way. Not that this is exactly the same thing, but it reminds me of that, the importance of acknowledging the other person's emotions. But in this principle, you say, differentiate between acknowledgement and agreement. Because,
yes,
of course, somebody might say something that you find really objectionable, maybe deeply offensive in one way or another, mm-hmm. and it probably runs contrary to every fiber of your being to do this bit of acknowledgement. I think it helps a lot to think of it as not agreeing. Acknowledging is not the same thing as agreeing.
It's so important. As you say, acknowledgement by itself is a very powerful action in a conflict, because people need to know, again, that they've been heard. And if we jump right in with our own response, either rejecting or accepting, then we've taken it, once again, to our point of view. And particularly when, as you say, people say things that we don't agree with, it's tempting to jump right back in and say, yeah, but no. But instead, if we can say things like, say there's some kind of a conflict about whether or not there should be armed guards at a school. If someone were to say, we need guns in the school, we need armed guards, we need controls, a person might be tempted to respond against that. But instead, to acknowledge it without agreeing creates a freedom for ourselves. We don't need to be trying to convince other people. What we need to do is figure out where people currently stand and, most importantly, why they stand there. So, for example, a simple acknowledgement about something you disagree with might be like, okay, it sounds like you're worried about your kids, and you'd feel more comfortable if the guards in the school carried guns. So there you've let them know you heard what they said. You see it as an important thing to them without having to either agree or disagree with it.
Towards that end, you also suggest that we keep the difference in mind between evaluation and observation, that sometimes what we really need to do is look carefully at other people, at what they're saying, what they're doing, what they're going through, but the matter of evaluating is kind of a different thing.
Yes, so evaluating either the person's personality or their actions is different than just describing how their action, what you saw them do and how it affected you. So, for example, if I say to somebody, you know, you're always late, which is an evaluation of them generally as a person, will probably provoke some kind of defensiveness. But if we stick just to the information and how it affected us, and we say, for example, you know, for the last 3 meetings you've been 30 minutes late, and I felt really frustrated because I need to get going in my morning, or something along those lines, then we've stuck with ourselves, what our experience was, and what the actual facts on the ground were and how it affected us, as opposed to starting to characterize that person as one thing or another.
Hmm. I want to just touch on a couple of other principles, and of course the point of this interview is to just get people intrigued by your book and what you are exploring in it. When we turn to the second portion of principles with the heading of Change the Conversation, I especially appreciate Principle 10.
Hmm.
In contrast to what we might do in a conflict situation, adopt a rigid stance, you suggest develop curiosity in difficult situations. I love that because it really speaks to the fact that we tend to do the opposite, that when we're in a conflict situation or a situation that's otherwise uncomfortable or scary, we tend to close up like a turtle into its shell.
Mm-hmm.
And you are suggesting just the opposite, at least, you know, mentally and emotionally, that would be so helpful in such a situation.
Yes, and what I find so exciting is that it really is something that we can learn through practice, because being able to stay curious in difficult situations is not part of our personality. It's really a skill, and the more we practice it, on all kinds of different levels, the more we're able to access that curiosity when we get in that kind of a situation. And we can practice it by getting used to asking ourselves questions that go for the why of things. Like, how does this make sense to her? Or what led this person to take this action? Or what is it that I am doing in this situation that's making this whole conversation more difficult? So becoming curious about the mechanics of the whole situation, as opposed to trying to either place blame or find ourselves innocent, instead to step away from the whole blame aspect of things, which focuses on past actions and punishment, and focus on looking at how our mindset can help us figure out what's going on, what's important to everybody, and what's possible as a result.
Hmm. There are so many other interesting ideas that are shared in this book, and I urge people to seek it out if they, like me, feel like they could do a whole lot better when it comes to the conflicts in our lives. Hmm. The book, again, is called Changing the Conversation, The 17 Principles of Conflict Resolution, published by Penguin. Dana Caspersen, I commend you for this good work and for this very, very interesting book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show.
Thank
Best
you
wishes.
So much. Such a pleasure to talk with you.
And the time is 8:49. Here's part two of today's Morning Show on WGTD. We spend this portion of The Morning Show talking about the life of one of the finest sportscasters in the country, Al Michaels. We're talking with L. John Wertheim from Sports Illustrated, who is the collaborator with Al Michaels on this memoir called You Can't Make This Up, Miracles, Memories, and the Perfect Marriage of Sports and Television. I spoke with L. John Wertheim most recently about his marvelous book, Strokes of Genius, which followed the twin paths of two of tennis's greatest geniuses, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. Again, this book by Al Michaels, You Can't Make This Up. L. John Wertheim, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you.
So can you say a quick word about how you exactly collaborated with Al Michaels on this memoir? I mean, who wrote what, or how did you work together?
It's a good question. I'd never done a book like this before, where it's a collaboration, and yet you want to capture the voice of the subject, in this case, Al Michaels. So basically, we did a lot of talking and a lot of conversation. Al, you can imagine, very easy guy to talk to, has this wealth of stories, and then it basically was my job to structure this in book form. So I've had colleagues who have written books like this with athletes, and they've said, oh, you know, this guy's 23 years old, and it's hard to get him to talk, and how am I going to get a book out of this? He hasn't done enough living. That was not an issue I faced. This was this was a lot of fun. This was probably a case of having so much material and editing and pairing rather than stretching words.
I imagine, given who you are and the work that you do, that to some extent you already knew Al Michaels. How well did you know him before this project began?
Yeah, honestly, not that. I mean, we were acquaintances, and I mean, kind of person you'd run into at a game every now and then to say hi, but you know, we weren't, you know, close friends or anything like that. And I think in a way that sort of helped, that I certainly knew Al Michaels, but I didn't know chapter and verse, and he knew me, but not, you know, again, with assumption that we had a ton of overlap. And so it allowed us to sort of start fresh. And it was a much different exercise from a process standpoint than any other book I had written. But it was great. Really, I think we were both real happy with how it worked out.
I think one of the things that I especially appreciate about the book is that, in addition to hearing all kinds of really incredible stories about the Miracle on Ice in Lake Placid in 1980 and other memorable moments, we learn a lot about how the world of sports and sports on television has changed so drastically over the years. And one of the themes which comes up very often in the early part of the book is how Al Michaels came to prominence at a time which seems now so antiquated in terms of technology. And some of what he and his colleagues were forced to accomplish was especially difficult given the technological limitations of the day. Can you maybe talk about one or two examples of what I'm talking about? I think it's a very, very interesting part of this story.
No, I mean, first, I appreciate you saying that. I mean, I think the best biographies and autobiographies have some deeper theme than just this compendium of stories and anecdotes, so I appreciate that. And yeah, that was something we tried to stress, that sports media has really changed a lot. Some of it's technology, some of it is just sort of our appetite, some of it's the money, and Al's been there the whole time. But you listen to some of his stories in the early going, whether it's, you know, the minor league baseball games, or even, you know, the Miracle on Ice game was on tape delay. I mean, people remember that game, and it wasn't even live. The outcome had already been decided. I mean, imagine that today. An event of that magnitude, U.S., Soviet, this underdog team, the Olympics. Imagine viewers not getting that in real time and not knowing the result, whether it was through Twitter or the crawl at the bottom of the screen or some other form of social media, when they tuned in. And, you know, along, I mean, some of this is just transmission. Some of this is, you know, ESPN did not exist when Al started his career. It's funny because as much as sports has changed, and, you know, whoever thought we'd have devices in our pockets that would double as phones and cameras and ways to watch clips when we're on airplanes, Al would also tell you that what he ultimately does for a job hasn't changed a whole lot in 40 years, that the distribution has and the method has and the speed has, but basically his job on Sunday nights isn't a whole lot different than what it was when his career was starting in the late 60s.
Hmm. I also appreciate how Al Michaels obviously has a marvelous grasp by now of how the work that he does has to vary from sport to sport, and not just because you're talking about a different sport, but with its own particular rules and so on, but that also pacing and rhythm and nuance is so different sport to sport. It specifically comes up at one point when he's talking about Ken Dryden, who was his broadcasting partner for that Miracle on Ice occasion, but he mentions in passing about, for instance, the drastic difference between being an on-air analyst during a hockey game versus during a football game. And it's not just that the rules of the game are different because the games are different, but the tools at your disposal and the means by which you're going to offer analysis, it's a completely different thing.
You know, that's a completely different thing. And the other thing that really struck me doing this book is that at one point, for kicks, we just started to count them up. And Al's had more than 100 partners. And what he has to do to work in conjunction with, you know, John Madden is totally different than what it is when he's working with, you know, just picking a Dennis Miller or Eric Dickerson or Bruce Jenner. And I think that there's a lot of versatility in games, and I think you're right. I mean, the rhythms and the cadences and sort of knowing when to let the action go. I mean, calling a baseball game is much different than calling a basketball game or calling a football game. But I also think Al has a real versatility in working alongside so many different people at so many different points in their career. Some of them were just novices, you know, Tommy Lasorda, who was managing 48 hours ago and suddenly he's in the booth, versus working alongside a guy like John Madden is a totally different exercise. And I think that Al's versatility also extends to how well he adapts to his partners.
Absolutely. Something else he talks about one point, and maybe it's because I'm also a voice teacher, it kind of grabbed my attention when he said this, is he mentions at one point continuously working, and particularly as a young announcer, on perfecting on how to use his voice as an instrument, wanting to match the crowd. You don't want to be shouting while the crowd is quiet. You don't want to be whispering when the crowd is screaming. I always want to be in sync with the action. That's the kind of rather subtle, basic point that nevertheless I think is probably lost on the rest of us. But what a huge difference it makes if you aren't sensitive to something like that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think not unlike being a referee, being a sports announcer is one of those jobs that, you know, I'm as guilty as anyone. We all sit at home and you say, I could do that. Or how come he's not mentioning the penalty that they got in the first half? And it's one of these games, it's one of these jobs that invites second guessing, and we all love and are passionate about sports, and it's one of these things that I think a lot of people say, I could do that. There's a lot that goes into it, and some of it is in the preparation and the getting the pronunciation of names right, but a lot of it is more nuanced. And I mean, that passage you write, the passage you just read, I think really illustrates that. There's a lot that goes on that these guys think about, and there's also a lot that they don't think about that just after so many years hopefully comes naturally.
Right, and he says at one point, on television, often less is more. I want to finish by mentioning that I think Al Michaels in this book does a wonderful job of speaking honestly and frankly and perceptively about the wide range of people with whom he's worked, some of whom he's not particularly fond of, and he's open about their faults, and yet this book also feels relatively kind and relatively respectful, and that seems like a tricky balancing act. I mean, he could be very cautious about other people's feelings and the book would end up being pretty bland. And on the other hand, he seems like a nice enough person that does not go out of his way to be unkind about other people and their weaknesses and foibles and flaws. Could you just say a word about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that also is sort of that's who he is. I mean, I think his instinct is to like people and give them the benefit of the doubt. I think most people he's worked with, he's liked, and vice versa, but not everyone. And I think he knew for this book to be authentic, he didn't have to settle old scores, and he didn't have to bury people. But, you know, when someone, you know, Boomer Esiason, to pick a name, when there were people that he didn't particularly care for, that wasn't something that he was gonna conceal. So, no, I mean, I think some people have read it, and they sort of said, you know, I wish it were more of a tell-all, and doesn't Al dislike more people, and I don't think that's the case, but also as you say, it can't all be rainbows and balloons.
No, so we hear some frank talk about Rune Arledge and Howard Cosell and Pete Rose and many other fascinating